Kitchen Garden on Community Radio Kilkenny City 88.7 FM with Frances Nesbitt and Mags Morrissey.
Hello and you're very welcome to the Kitchen Garden on Community Radio Kilkenny City. I am Frances Nesbitt from Cromwell Cottages here in Kilkenny and I'm joined as usual by Mags Morrissey from Hedgehog Bakery. And we're live today, Friday, from 4 to 5 and the show is repeated next Monday from 4 to 5, same time. Now, we'd love to hear from you today if you have any questions or comments on any of the topics that we cover in the show, so please feel free to get in touch with us. You can email kitchengarden@crkc.ie or you can send us a text to 086 353 7782. Now, on the show today, lots and lots to talk about. We're going to be talking about some food news now in a second, some timely recipes from Mags, and then a little later on, I have an interview to play for you that I recorded with the great Diana Henry while we were over at Food on the Edge a couple of weeks ago, and we'll be talking about the state of British food, and we'll be talking about the state of Irish food. And then in Nature Notes today, we'll be talking about red wings and field fairs and feeding the birds at this time of the year. And of course, I have a list of jobs for everybody to be doing in the garden. Mags, how are you?
I'm very good.
How was your week?
Well, I haven't been blown away or washed away, so grand.
It's shocking out there, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a little bit wild, all right. You know the way they've all these weather warnings, so, you know, and you kind of take no notice now unless it's red, because we kind of heard them all, and there's every nearly second week it feels like there's one, but this one was quite nearly underreported, I think, because it does feel kind of towards the orangey, doesn't it, a little bit?
Well, here at the station in Kilkenny, the car park next door is a little higher than our car park, and I just went out to the car there a second ago and there's water flowing through the wall from the car park next door, so I didn't really notice that much rain falling, but obviously it's been falling consistently. Yeah.
Well, I even have the geese like standing looking into the kitchen.
Let me in.
Like just looking.
It's such a pity we don't have a camera in the studio, because Mags just did an impression of the geese at the glass door looking in. That was amazing. For a second there, I was in the studio with a goose. Incredible. So, food this week, Mags, what have you been up to? What have you been cooking and enjoying?
Well, getting pork ready. So
It was that time, was it?
The piggies got loaded up on Sunday, actually. Probably the easiest load ever. They literally just walked up and closed the back and stuff. Yeah, and so very easy. And brought them down to Wexford. And I was feeling, I always feel actually a little bit sad when they're going, because you do get a little bit attached to them. And anyway, it did feel a bit sad until I opened the box and they'd flippin' like lifted the mats off the ground, off the floor of the box and stuff, and made a huge mess. So that sort of killed my my sadness a little bit. Helped me cope, actually.
So I've said it before here that I find the animals that are destined for the table, somehow something happens and I never really form an attachment with them, and it's because they do something on me, or they're constantly escaping, or they just have a shifty look in their eye or something.
Oh, these were divils, but I kind of was kind of fond of them as well. But anyway, they went to a nice place. Well, you know the place down in Wexford. So and there was lots of other Sandian blacks arriving in on the same day.
Oh, brilliant.
And I actually met a couple who were bringing three big pigs, actually. And she said something like, well, I can't lift these, so I can't kill them myself. So literally, if she can lift an animal, she'll kill it.
Wow.
So she kills her own geese and chickens and goats.
But my God.
Pigs are a bit too heavy to lift.
Yeah.
Now, he doesn't do any of it. She does it
herself.
Yeah.
Wow, some woman.
Some woman, actually,
Well, there are winches in Aldi and Lidl all the time, so maybe she needs just to get herself a winch.
I didn't suggest
it. But it used to happen at every farmstead in the country not so long ago. You know, an animal... I've read the article. Did you read Diana Henry's interview with Richard Corrigan during the week?
Well, I love him anyway. I've been a fan for years and stuff.
She is clearly a fan as well. And she interviewed Richard Corrigan. He was talking about his upbringing on a farm. They were dirt poor, apparently. But a lot of their food came from the farm itself. But his abiding memory of bacon was just excessive salt, because they cured their own. Everything was preserved in salt, so it was very, very, very salty. But it was done on every farm.
When I was a very small girl, there were pigs on the farm and that, and they would have been killed. Yeah.
Yeah.
But we have removed ourselves a bit from that. I couldn't imagine myself going out and killing a pig, actually.
Yeah.
Or a goat.
It's the one part of the butchery courses out at Crowan where in the past we've had a person kind of excuse themselves for a few minutes. When the deer is kind of hanging from a winch and it's, you know, processed from there, because it still looks like an animal, you know.
Oh, yes.
When
yeah,
the meat
yeah.
looks like meat, people seem to be able to handle it much easier. But when it looks like an animal and you're processing it into meat, sometimes that stage can be a bit much.
Yeah, I think it's the live to dead stage that would probably get me the most.
Yeah. When the head is gone, it's easier.
Yeah, I suppose it is, isn't it? So the pigs, getting three different types of sausages made. So looking forward to getting those back probably next week, actually.
Very good.
Yeah.
And your own recipes?
Adapted from Ballymaloe.
Very good. Very good.
They're based on Ballymaloe's recipes, in fairness. And I've used them actually over the last couple of years. One, a Toulouse sausage, which has some red wine, kind of more of an adulty type sausage, and nutmeg, garlic, parsley and thyme, and that's very nice. And then another paysan, I think it's called, which is parsley, thyme, garlic and pepper and salt.
Oh, sounds lovely.
But a lot of herbs in it. So yeah, they should be nice.
And Betty's going to make those for you down there.
Betty's going to make those, yeah.
It's great, that butcher, where you're able to just arrive with your ingredients and this is for 5 kilos of mince and away you go.
Oh, she's brilliant. And you know, you want this thing done this way and the other, and the people in front of me wanted all sorts of different things and that, and I was thinking, oh my god, I was starting to get impatient actually, and she was actually, this is what she does, very nice woman. So
lovely, and fantastic little butchers, and long may they continue, because I saw also in Food News during the week that in the last 3 months 14 craft butchers shops have closed in the country, which is really, when you think of it, in 3 months,
that's an awful lot. It is. It's very sad, actually.
It is very sad.
It is a proper craft, and you don't get, it's not, you know, supermarkets don't replace that at all.
I was speaking to somebody who was a butcher and now is a manager in a supermarket, and he was telling me that really the lads they have working on the butcher's counters, they're not butchers. The training they do is very, very minimal, so they can carve up cuts that come in already, but like if you were to present them with a carcass, they wouldn't have a clue what to do with it.
Yeah, but they don't need to do that, I suppose. Exactly. So they're not, yeah. I think we definitely need to support our butchers.
Well, there's a promo on this station saying all the time, please support local to keep the city alive. And really, that's true. No matter where you're listening to us from, use your local retailers while you have them, because you may miss them when they're gone. And there's nothing worse or more depressing than looking at empty shops on the high street or main street, depending on where you're
living. And when you want to go and get a cheap cut of meat or something special, you won't get it in the supermarkets. It's the butchers, and you can phone them and order it. I do that regularly if I want something unusual, and they will always do their best to get it for you.
Yeah,
so
it's true. It's true. And the greater variety we have, I think, of little shops around the place, the greater the benefit they have to each other, you know.
Yeah.
And all the supermarkets tend to be out of town now, and we're really creating this kind of donut, this ring effect that America suffered a long time ago. When I was in college in America in 1989, I saw this firsthand in Scranton. Scranton had a beautiful downtown area, stunning buildings, incredible. And virtually every building was empty because all of the shops had moved out to the mall. Nobody went into the centre of the city anymore at all. Now, it was a small city, maybe the size of Galway, but can you imagine the centre of Galway just being completely empty and everybody going to the malls outside? And people were writing about it back then, like this could happen in Ireland, and now we're living it. So support your local business where you possibly can.
Yes, true.
Now, you wanted to talk a little bit about war biscuits.
Yeah, a little bit of food history for the week that's in it, just to have the food angle on the World War I. 100 years ago, these biscuits were made by Jacobs in Dublin. And Jacobs, I think you probably know more about the Jacobs factory than I might, but it was the biggest private employer in the country during the First World War, only interrupted really for the Easter Rising when Thomas Macdonough took it over, and so it was kind of didn't produce for that week, but there was very little fighting there, so once that was finished they just went back into production the following week, they produced a thing called hard tack biscuits, which were, do you know this?
Well, I've heard of hard tack biscuits, yeah.
So they were sent to the front. Now, they were considered kind of tasteless staples, but very portable. So I suppose they had to survive going from here to the various trenches. And they were apparently broke many a soldier's tooth, but they still ate them. But anyway, somebody who was doing a bit of history on Jacobs decided to give the culinary arts students at DIT just a task of reproducing the biscuits that they had. So there was these other biscuits called Verdun, named after a battle. I thought you might know the battle.
The Battle of Verdun, of course.
Excuse me. It was the Germans and the French in 1916. And nobody... Excuse me, sorry about that.
Hardtack biscuits, you know, date back long before World War One. Hardtack biscuits were a staple of the kind of Napoleonic era navy. So they would have been biscuits that the sailors on the sailing ships would have had.
Oh, okay.
And these would be biscuits that were baked once and then they'd last forever. And all you needed to do was, if you wanted to stay vegetarian, pick out the weevils and have your biscuit.
So they were rock hard. But these other ones, the Verdun biscuits, and they had just saw a little picture of the packets, which looked, well, like biscuits from 100 years ago. They were produced, anyway, the first produced in 1917 in Dublin, and in two factories in the UK. And they used to send, I don't know, 1.something million packets of these biscuits out to the war every week.
Oh my God.
So it would have been huge production-wise. It would have been massive at the time. So anyway, they were considered a treat for the soldiers after the hardtack biscuits because they were a little bit softer and they had just the faintest hint of coconut, apparently. So that sounds a little bit exciting and exotic, doesn't it?
Very exotic. I wonder how faint was the faintest hint.
I don't know.
One coconut per week, maybe.
And the ingredients include, they had flour, wheat meal, some kind of a wholemeal, I suppose, maize, it was a biscuit powder, which I don't know what that is, dark sugar. And then there was two other ingredients that wouldn't be recognisable now. One was called nucoline and the other was latine. So the nucoline was some kind of an early form of margarine type stuff, and the other was some kind of milk powder. So the students, anyway, there was loads of lard, lots and lots of lard, which would have, I suppose, preserve them and made them kind of soft and that.
Given you the kind of calorie hit that you want, like that was the whole idea of these.
They would have needed them,
So they were easily preserved. They wouldn't go off unless they got damp. So long as you kept them dry, they'd last forever.
And apparently you could drive a tank over these and they'd be okay. Yeah. So the students made them and kind of passed them around to see what people thought of them. People thought they were absolutely horrendous. Some people thought they'd tasted worse, but they wouldn't really match.
I'm sure you would have been glad of them, though, if they were starving.
I'm sure they were. But also Jacobs USA. You know the Jacobs USA range?
Mm-hmm.
Do you know when that was first launched?
I don't, actually. And my mother used to work for Jacobs.
I knew you had a connection,
Long, long, long time ago. Yeah, Lord have mercy on her now, but she worked in Jacobs, yes.
And in Bishop's, what was it called, Bishop's Road?
Yeah, Bishop Street, is it? And they used to get packets of broken biscuits as part of their treat at the end of the week. They bring home packets of broken biscuits, and for a long time afterwards you could get Jacob's broken biscuits even in local shops around when I was a kid.
My grandfather used to sell bags of broken biscuits.
Isn't it, for very, very low money?
But the Jacob's USA range, they were first introduced in 1918, and that was to celebrate the Americans' entry into the war.
I did not know that.
No, I didn't know that.
Little nuggets like that. That's fantastic.
Isn't it?
It is.
And they're still like Christmas kind of favourite, aren't they? Or they are a Christmas staple, maybe. I'm not sure.
I feel like I need to make a confession.
You stole.
When I was young, the Christmas shopping would start at around about now. And then the biscuit tins would be bought first if they were on special or something. And they would go into the top of my mother's wardrobe.
I'm afraid I know what's coming.
One year, I carefully unwrapped the sellotape from the lid of the box of USA biscuits. I took out one of the sections of chocolate biscuits and I replaced it with plain biscuits from in the kitchen. And I kept those 6 or 7 chocolate biscuits for myself and I ate them over 2 or 3 days. And then I carefully resealed the box so nobody ever knew.
Do you think she didn't know?
On Christmas Day, when my dad opened the box of biscuits, he was like, Jesus, it's worse every year. There's fewer chocolate biscuits.
Jesus.
So Jacobs were blamed for kind of cutting costs when really it was me. I'd taken them.
Did you feel very bad?
I feel a bit better now, actually, that I've kind of gotten that off my chest. I've carried that with me for 40 years.
Do they have the ones with the jelly centre?
They had the jelly centre ones as well, with the chocolate with the jelly in the middle.
Oh, yeah.
They were good.
So that's where they came from. So those that range are 100 years old.
If you listen to the show for nothing else now, that was worth learning.
It was, wasn't it?
I love tins of USA biscuits and I love nuggets of information like that. Now, Sprouts are also on your list of things to talk about today, but we'll leave that until we come back, will we, after the break? Because I want to talk about the state of Irish food as well,
yeah,
and
sure.
Board B report. Okay. But we better take an ad break. We'll be back just after these. Call us now on 056-7762-777.
The Gourmet Store, High Street, Kilkenny, for homemade scones and brown bread with soup and tasty treats. Freshly made every day. Contact us on 056-77-71727. The Gourmet Store, home of international and local foods.
Shortest Wong, Kilkenny's World Food Store on John Street, Kilkenny City. Unique Irish imported foods and sauces along with organic fruit juices and grains. Contact us on 056-77-61305 or email shortestwong@hotmail.com. Shortest Wong, Kilkenny's World Food Store.
Glossary and Goodies, Gorin, specialising in organic foods, home baking, free-range eggs and takeout food. Glossary and Goodies is on the main street in Gorin, beside Old Square in the village. Email siobhan@glossarygoodies.com or phone 056-77-33-799. Glossary and Goodies, Gorin.
Grogan and Brown Artisan Butchers, purveyors of fine food in Kilkenny City. Local food for local people by Grogan and Brown, your award-winning artisan butcher in Smithsland Centre, Loughboy. View our products on Facebook page Grogan and Brown Artisan Butchers or call us on 056-77-64799. Grogan and Brown Artisan Butchers, your award-winning artisan butcher in Smithsland Centre, Loughboy.
In Flanders fields, the poppies blow between the crosses, row on row.
Join me, Pat Shortle, in the company of Liam Langrell, just after 11 a.m. this Sunday, for a special programme commemorating the 100th anniversary of the cessation of World War I.
You can email the show, kitchengarden@corkc.ie.
Kitchen Garden is sponsored by the Artisan Food Retailers of Kilkenny.
And you're very welcome back to the Kitchen Garden on Community Radio Kilkenny City. I am Francis Nesbitt from Crowland Cottages and I'm joined by Mags Morrissey from Hedgehog Bakery. And we're live today, Friday, from 4 to 5. And the show is repeated on Mondays from 4 to 5. And while we're live on air, you can text us to 086-353-7782. And there's a couple of texts in there about hard tack biscuits. We might get to those in a couple of minutes.
Yeah.
But you wanted to talk to us about sprouts.
Do you like sprouts?
I love sprouts.
Yeah, so do I.
Love them.
Now that they're not like boiled to
oblivion,
yeah, and served in large quantities.
I absolutely love them and I like them just as sprouts. So I don't like those recipes that kind of disguise the sprouts. So like, here's a way to eat sprouts, but they taste like bacon and maple syrup, you know.
Yes, yes.
I like sprouty sprouts.
Well, they have a lovely kind of nutty, robust nutty kind of flavour in that.
Love them. Haven't had them in ages, actually,
well,
now that you remind me, no.
Great source of vitamins and or fibre and folic acid and vitamin C. So they're very good for us. They're mostly grown in Ireland and they're available from like August to March. So we don't need to wait until Christmas for them. I would actually buy them regularly enough. I don't grow them at the moment.
I've never been another admission now. Today is just all about confessions for me. But Brussels sprouts are the one thing that I've just never managed to produce in the garden properly.
Yeah, they're a bit trickier, I think, aren't they?
I don't know what it is. I protect them and stuff, but something seems to get into them. And even when I have a nice big stalk of what looked like sprouts, when I go to harvest them, pull the leaves off, every little sprout has been damaged by slugs or something.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, I've never
achieved. You can eat the leaves as well, actually. You can eat other parts of the plant, not just the actual sprout as we know it.
Oh, of course, yeah, because they're brassicas.
Yeah, of course you can, yeah. So, yeah, they're one of the cabbage...
I must ask Dermot Carey sometime what's his secret. I'm sure he produces lovely sprouts.
Apparently the frost is good for flavour in the sprouts. So it kind of gets rid of any bitterness or anything that might be there. So they're generally good, better eaten after the first frost.
Oh, okay, okay.
Apparently... And they stayed kind of, Brussels, they do come from Belgium. So until the kind of early 19th century, they kind of were very unknown outside of Belgium and kind of northern France, even though they would have been probably first cultivated by the Romans 1200s or something like that. Never used in Mediterranean cooking or in Asian cooking, but I think they're great in a stir fry.
Oh, yeah, of course they would be, because you'd have that kind of green and crispness.
And you'd often put like cabbage or something into it, but they're much handier. Just slice them up and pop them into a stir fry. I made a risotto with sprouts actually recently enough, which is quite nice.
I like them just steamed. Steamed with spuds and bacon and then parsley sauce.
Yeah, that's good, yeah.
Lashings and lashings of parsley sauce. Yeah. Love it.
But you can do other things with them as well, you know, because like if you're going to use them from, let's say, August to March and stuff, you can do different things. You could serve them like with a little bit of sesame seed oil and sesame seeds and maybe some oyster sauce or something if you wanted that style of a thing. Or then you can do something that you might not like because it involves like...
Disguising the sprouts.
Well, I think enhancing them actually.
And this is well done.
Nigel Slater one, which he's a great man for, like, no veg. There isn't a vegetable that can't be enhanced by adding cream and cheese to it. But this, I've done this loads of times, and I think it's brilliant, actually. Do you want the recipe for this?
Go ahead, then.
You might be converted.
So you put a moustache on each sprout, and then... No, it's not that kind of disguise. Okay, sorry.
Yeah, no, it's not. So about 600 grams of Brussels sprouts, a little nutmeg, some double cream, about 250 mils, and about 100 grams of grated Parmesan. So just prepare your sprouts by taking off the bottom leaves. I'd cut off any bit of stalk as well there,
but
you don't have to. And then cook them for about 4 minutes whole in boiling water, a little bit of salt. Then drain them. Put your sprouts into the food processor with some pepper and salt. Give them a blitz just until they're coarse, not pureed or anything like that. So just until they're nicely chopped, roughly chopped, I suppose. Then season with a little bit of nutmeg. Then stir in the cream and most of the cheese, and then scoop this into a baking dish. So a nice little baking dish, and scatter the rest of the Parmesan on top and pop it into the oven for about 20 minutes. And until it gets a little bit kind of toasty and brown on the top, it's really delicious.
That sounds very good.
It is very nice, yeah.
And a very traditional kind of Irish recipe, aren't they? But they really are, traditional ingredient in Ireland, but they really are something that people either love or they hate.
And I think if they're overcooked, that they don't taste nice and they kind of have a smell sometimes, kind of that like cabbage, you know, that, you know, canteen cabbagey type smell and that, which, you know, are a hospitally overcooked kind of vegetable smell. So, and you do need to be careful not to overcook them.
Isn't it funny how some people, when they have a nasty experience of a food like that, there's just no going back. They can never return to it. I remember once my mother sent me down to the supermarket to get a head of cabbage and they were sold out, and I was asking the lady in the shop, do you have any cabbages? I must have been quite young at the time, and she said, no, but these are like cabbages, and gave me sprouts, and I brought them home, and I thought my mother was going to disown me. Like, the look of horror on her face when I presented her with these, to me they looked like little mini cabbages. I'd never had them in my life. She sent me straight back to the supermarket with these things to get rid of them. No, she wasn't going to have them in the house. It was me or the sprouts. So we didn't have cabbage that day. I don't know what we had. But
traditionally they were just served here at Christmas.
Yeah.
Which is a pity, really, because they're quite versatile and they're quick to cook as well, if you're looking for, you know, and they've got all the nutrients and they're grown here.
I love them as part of the Christmas dinner. I do. But I like them. I like them anyway. Really, really simply done. A very traditional Irish ingredient. And speaking of traditional Irish fare and all of that, did you read the reports from the Bord Bia Food Service Sector conference that was on during the week?
Yeah, I saw bits and pieces from it, all right. Yes.
Some fairly startling kind of statistics out of it, really, weren't there?
Yeah, but I suppose some of it's not... Maybe statistics are surprising, but it's not overly surprising, you know, that we're changing our eating habits, is it, in the last couple of years? You know, if you even think about yourself, what you do every day, compared to what... how you would have been brought up with the dinner at the dinner time, and that we don't often have the dinner at the dinner time now. Brunch, and you know, weekends people sometimes have like almost two meals, brunch and then dinner later or something. So I suppose, but some of it is a bit frightening how much.
The amount of money that's being spent as well. Food services, what they call anything that, any meal that's had outside the house. So food service, the food service sector might be everything from the food you grab in the garage to a sit-down dinner in a Michelin-star restaurant. And this year, I suppose as a consequence of the recession being over, that whole sector is set to grow by 6.1%, they reckon, to a value of 8.2 billion euro will be spent in Ireland on food outside the home. That's a huge market.
It is huge, yeah.
And like you were saying, they were saying that, you know, we're no longer sitting down to three meals a day. It's just not the norm anymore. And families are eating together a lot less. There's an awful lot more grazing going on. So people might eat five, six, seven times a day. No one thing kind of considered like a proper meal, you know. So you'll be having a bar and a coffee on your way to work. At 11, you'll have like a piece of fruit or another treat with a coffee. At lunchtime, you'll grab a sandwich at your desk. In the afternoon, you'll get another little snack with your coffee at 3. On the way home, you might have a packet of crisps and something.
Oh God, I'm exhausted.
Really? And then when you get home, you'll order in rather than cook. And then there'll be some other snack before bed. And that's the eating habits now of most in the commuter class, so like in the city and traveling to and from.
It just doesn't sound very healthy. It doesn't really, when you say it like that.
It doesn't. And when you look at it and put a value beside all of those things, that's an awful lot of money every day that you're spending on food, convenience foods. And when you see the word convenient, when I see the word convenient, to me, that is just another way of saying money.
Expensive.
Yeah, really, it's expensive.
Value added. Yeah.
Really, yeah. So you grab this bar, which has all of the things you need to get you going in the day. Fine, but that's probably going to cost you a couple of euro. Your bowl of porridge in the morning will cost you a few cent, or a bowl of granola or something like that, you know. And I always found when I was living that lifestyle in Dublin, so when I was having something on the go all the time, I was grazing frequently because I was hungry frequently. Now, I have granola and banana and a natural yogurt for breakfast every morning. I'm not hungry until 1 o'clock.
Actually, that's a great breakfast.
It is a great breakfast.
Yeah.
And so you don't eat at 11. You don't need to eat at 11 before your kind of lunch rolls around. But things are all changing. And Tara McCarthy, the chief executive of Bord Bia, is kind of continuing to see good things on the horizon, and there'll be further growth in this sector, and it's a great opportunity for Irish food businesses and so on. But that's great. But I would wonder what it's actually doing to the Irish waistline, you know.
And also, I suppose a lot of some of the takeaway typey places. I can't stop thinking about that donut, the new donut place. What's it?
Krusty Krem
or something. Like, you know, hopefully not a huge amount of our money has been spent in places like that, which I fear probably is, actually, which is kind of scary.
Yeah, well, they do show, like, the statistics do also show that consumers are looking for experiences as well as, like, the convenience type stuff. And so, you know, we're part of this social media generation where we like to share the experiences that we're having. So if we're eating out somewhere, we want people to know that we're eating out somewhere. And if we're doing something, we want people to know that. And the Krusty Krem thing, I think, fitted into that. For some reason, it developed a certain cachet that, look, I'm there as well. I managed to get a box of these things, which are hard to get. Now, humans have always wanted to do that. They've always wanted to celebrate being, you know, slightly different or whatever, even if it is slightly different, just like everybody else.
Yeah.
But that's the state of
eating, really, isn't it?
That's the state of the Irish food. But while I was at Food on the Edge in Galway a couple of weeks ago, I got to talk to some very, very interesting people there about the state of food in various countries around the world. And I listened to a panel discussion on the state of British food that had some very interesting chefs on it. And that was compared by the great Diana Henry, of whom I'm a huge fan. Her cookbooks are absolutely amazing. One of them was our cookbook of the year last year, Simple, and her latest cookbook is just as good. Now, I interviewed Diana Henry while I was there, and we're going to listen to that now. And I've edited this to take out some of the bits where I was obviously just too much of a fan. But excuse me if this does sound a little gushing. So, Diana Henry at Food on the Edge, lovely to finally meet you. Big, big fan of yours.
Thank you.
Of your writing as well as you on social media.
And you've just compared a very difficult discussion about British
don't
food.
Don't talk to me. I don't. Well, chefs can never be. They won't. They just will not be calm. They will not fall in line. So Paul Cunningham was very, very difficult to control.
He's a bit of a messer, I think, is he?
If I'd had a ruler, he would have had it on the back of his hands.
I liked his the name of his recipe, cottaging pie.
No,
thought that was
we will draw a veil over that right now. Frankly, I don't think half the audience actually knew what that meant. There's quite a lot of Nordic people here.
Apparently Stephen Fry got the joke on Twitter, and he was fond of it a little while ago. So
I think it's run its course now, though.
Well, you did well to keep them in check.
Oh, my God.
And to move on from the horror stories of Iceland in the 1970s to the future of British food.
A lot of the chefs that I've met are like that. They were brought up with really terrible food. I mean, Klaus Meyer, you know, who started the whole New Nordic thing with René Redzepi. I mean, it would make you cry when you listen to him about the stuff he grew up with. He called it ding food. Everything was in the microwave.
Yeah, yeah.
And that awful margarine that they produced in Denmark at that time. So it took him to go to... He went to France for a year. He was going to be an au pair, and it was the food there that turned him on to food. He thought, my God, does this stuff actually exist? Is this the stuff that some people eat? Then he went back to Copenhagen and started to import truffles and olive oil and French and Italian stuff, blah, 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 blah. And then he thought... But I'm doing this all the wrong way around because I'm trying to get fantastic food and I'm getting it from these other countries. Why can't we get that here? So that's a very seminal moment, I think, in the cooking and the way we look at food in kind of like a northern countries, that he decided, yeah, what's wrong with carrots, turnips, beets? It doesn't have to be truffles and olives. And I admire him tremendously for that.
I was at a Gil Meller, his book launch in Ireland
recently.
He's
fabulous.
Yes, but of the entire evening, the nicest thing I put in my mouth that evening was a piece of beetroot. It was just absolutely gorgeous. Now, the rest of the dishes were all lovely, but this was just remarkable.
You see, we only used to pickle it, and now we're roasting it and putting it with different cheese and making it into tarts, and oh my God, I did a wonderful beetroot with a little apple in it as well, and blackberry soup.
Oh.
Well, I got the inspiration for that from Georgia, former USSR, Georgia, not Georgia in the deep south. And they do combine those things there. And then I made a kind of a walnut relish for the top, which was bashed walnuts, a little bit of garlic, some cayenne, olive oil, a little lemon juice, and dill, fresh dill. Then you put that on top, and you put more fresh blackberries on top as well. That is absolutely fantastic.
Is my face giving away the fact that I'm going to
you're
steal
thinking,
that?
You're thinking, I can see you've already made it. There's a pot waiting for you back
exactly,
at home.
Exactly.
Well,
that.
You can do it. You
when
can
are
eat
you
it
publishing that? Maybe I can get it out first.
You can't have that for that. No, that goes in my book. You can cook it. That's all you're doing with it.
I love your books. I absolutely love your books.
I put my heart and soul into them. You have
it's
no
so
idea.
Obvious.
I can be sitting at 4 o'clock in the morning fiddling about. You do this thing called a flat plan to look at all the dishes that are going to go in and where they're going to go. And then I think, nah, I don't like that. I think that's good enough, so I'm going to put in something different. Or when it gets to the end, when I've nearly finished the photography, I think, you know what? There's not enough neutral colours in this book. I'd like some white, and I'd like some black, and I'd like some beige, because publishers are always terrified of beige. They don't want beige food. Beige food is lovely. So then I go and I pull recipes out and I put other ones in again because I think the colours are wrong. So I take it to the nth
degree.
Oh
my God.
Take it to the nth degree.
Well, Simple was our cookbook of the year on the show last year.
Really?
Well, along with, I have to say, Gather by Gil Meller. So there was joint winners.
I'm a fan of his, so we can be joint winners because we love each other.
He teaches at my place.
Does he really?
Yeah, he comes over and does some courses there.
I'm sorry we didn't get on to talking about Gil Meller at the Food on the Edge discussion about British food. He is the cook stroke writer who really is doing modern British food. I think it's not fancy, it's very thoughtful, but he takes all of the ingredients round from where he lives in the southwest. But he's doing really, he cooks like a French person with British ingredients, but not with the French technique that chefs like Claire Smith apply. It's just very doable stuff. But I think he is absolutely where British food kind of is and should be at. Not enough of us are cooking like him. We're all obsessed with, and it's my fault too, as well as Yota Motulenge's, we're like obsessed with the Middle East. That's been all along. And we're obsessed even more with Italian. I mean, whatever did we used to eat before we could roast Mediterranean vegetables?
It's incredible.
What did we eat?
But chefs are obsessed by looking north. They're all focused on the Nordics. Well, at least they have been
for
the last
few years. Not Paul Cunningham. I mean, he's there, but he's going the new Nordic. When I said in there that I thought René Redzepi was responsible for us eating beetroot, he laughed at me. Did you hear him laughing at me?
I did.
He's wrong. Because when you get a chef of that caliber, and he has such profile and exposure, and he is writing about turnips, and he loves beetroot, not just for pickling, that has an effect.
Of course.
Eventually.
Yes.
I do. There's many ways in which I do not believe in the trickle-down theory, but I do believe in it, funny enough, when it comes to restaurants.
Well, events like this, I think, have a kind of trickle-up effect, because I'm looking around here and there's an awful lot of young people from GMIT that are studying the catering arts, art skills, and they're watching the videos, they're hearing people speak. All of the things they're talking about here about being nice to each other in the kitchens,
no, that's really
sourcing
important.
Your ingredients properly, being a bit kind of sensitive
the
about
restaurant,
what you're using.
The whole restaurant thing is changing.
It is.
I mean, it'll take a long time still, but they are now kinder places. I mean, listen to Claire Smith. She is the most zen woman ever. She's serene, never mind calm. So her kitchen, I wouldn't think there'd be any swearing or bollocking of people in there.
I can't imagine so. Wouldn't make great telly, but it's a nice place to work.
Yeah, exactly. I like her. I like what she's brought to the whole chef scenario.
I love that you're talking about everybody else, but I want to talk about your books.
Okay.
I love your books so much. Simple is the first cookbook that I ever opened and thought, I'll cook that. What page am I on now?
Do you know what? Because it passes. I think very hard about that. Because I knew, because I've got a cookbook collection of my own. I've got 4,000 books.
Oh my God.
What? I started buying cookbooks when I was 12. And when you go into a bookshop and you pick up a cookbook and you flick through it and you flick through to think, you have to have at least 6 dishes that you can't resist, okay? So a cookbook has to pass the flick test. You have to be standing there in the shop, and if you see recipe after recipe where you think, oh my God, I can't do without that, that sounds irresistible, you'll buy the book.
But the other thing is, all the recipes I've cooked from your book are delicious.
I know.
And they work.
I'm not just doing the flick test for nonsense. Also, the recipes do have to be good. I test them. But they're simple. There's nothing chefy about them at all. I try not to make things complicated because I'm quite an idle cook myself. And I like big flavors. And I like a lot of kind of like, I want kind of big bang for my buck, basically. So whatever effort I put in, it's got to be on the plate. You've got to kind of like get, oh, wow, this is good.
There was another book out around the same time, a simple by a very, 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 very famous chef. And it was rubbish. All of the recipes I tried for it, none of them worked.
Everybody is always trying to do the simple thing because it's what we want to do, and I don't mind that. I think, you know, I've got kids, I work full time. I have to cook plenty of things on a Wednesday night that just, you know, bung it in the oven things. But they get it. I think they get it wrong quite often when you think about simple stuff. I can't be doing with 3 or 4 ingredients. It's quite hard to make food wonderful with kind of like 3 or 4 ingredients. I think you have to look at big flavors. That's how you make food that's very simple, but will really kind of stop you in your tracks. It's the flavors that you add to something. I could roast chicken thighs in 1,000 ways and they would all be different, but you haven't done much more than add kind of flavorings and then you let the heat of the oven do its work. I mean, cooking is amazing because you have to do very little. If you've kind of got a few ideas and you've shopped well, then you can make terrific food. I mean, this kind of notion that people can't cook, it makes me upset. It's just nonsense. I want everybody to cook and everybody to feel that they're able to cook and to get pleasure out of it. But it can stay simple, good ideas, good ingredients, that's it.
That was a fabulous way to kind of finish, I think. I absolutely love your books. Diana Henry, thanks very much for speaking to me.
A pleasure.
You can email the show, kitchengarden@corkc.ie. Text us on 086-353-7782.
Kitchen Garden is sponsored by the Artisan Food Retailers of Kilkenny.
And you're very welcome back to the Kitchen Garden on Community Radio Kilkenny City. I'm Francis Nesbitt from Crow and Cottages, and I'm here as usual with Mags Morrissey from Hedgehog Bakery. And we're live today up until 5 o'clock, and the show is repeated on Mondays from 4 to 5. And you can get in touch with us by text or email kitchengarden@ckc.ie. Diana Henry is a great character. Absolutely,
yes,
brilliant character.
She,
hilarious. But she said at the end of that interview, "You got me in when I'm in a good mood today. Sometimes I'm a bit grumpier." And I was thinking, I could picture it.
Yeah.
I could picture it. I really can.
I imagine there's not a long time between the two.
No. I'd say she takes no prisoners and no nonsense. But it might have come across that I was obviously a big fan, so maybe that influenced her. But it was hilarious seeing her trying to keep these chefs in check, particularly Paul Cunningham. And I've an interview for him that I'll play next week. Maybe he's a 2-star Michelin chef from England, but living now up in Denmark. To get 2 stars in Denmark,
yeah,
wow,
yeah.
That has to be something. And he's in the middle of nowhere in the western part of Jutland, so it's out in the middle of absolutely nowhere. People helicopter into the restaurant. Very, very special. But he is such a messer, and he was winding her up and winding everybody else on the panel up. Hilarious.
Brilliant.
Now, in Nature Notes, you wanted to talk to us about Red Wings.
And field fairs. When you were talking about your nostalgic USA biscuits earlier and stuff, I was thinking about, not at exactly the same time, but when I was a kid, I was a little bit of a birder. I would have known all the kind of garden birds. And then suddenly one winter, saw these new birds out. It was a big field out of the front of the house and stuff. Saw this kind of little flock of new birds to me and stuff. And I was thinking, I was actually quite excited. I can still remember, I can still picture the scene actually. And they were Red Wings. So they had just come in for the winter and stuff. And but I was just, I suppose at that age, maybe I thought, I knew all the birds.
Yeah.
And I was quite, and then there was these, suddenly there
something
was something
exotic.
New and exciting.
Yeah.
And then trying to work out field fares from thrushes. That's why I thought of these today, actually. So the blackbird is your Turdus marula, and then the field fare is your Turdus polaris, and the red wing is Turdus ilicus.
So okay.
Do you remember all of those?
So
now?
It's a member of the thrush family.
It is, yeah. And the field fare look a little bit thrushy. You know, they're kind of brown and speckledy.
Yep.
They're about the same size as a blackbird. So maybe not as chunky looking as a thrush. And they've got more of a grey cap to their head and grey at their backs. But you'll see them, they'll generally be in the countryside. And
okay.
You'll often see those kind of in little flocks as well, on kind of grassland or maybe on a stubble field or something like that.
Now, they're not year-round residents here,
no,
are they?
They're only here for the winter. So they don't breed here. They breed in kind of northern Europe, in towards kind of Russia. And come here, I suppose, early autumn until early spring, just for feeding. And
okay,
but they're quite common. They're not. There's no concern about them conservation wise.
Where do they come to us from?
Northern Europe and kind of towards Russia, that direction.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
Finland, Russia, that's Scandinavia.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then the Red Wing then come from kind of Northern Europe and Iceland. And they're a smaller little bird.
Isn't that funny now that somebody comes to us for the winter from Iceland? Like, Iceland is a long way away.
It is, isn't it? Yeah. And they're little birds, you know, fly all this way. So, yeah.
But I suppose the swallows come to us all the way from Africa, so, you know, shouldn't be that surprising. That's incredible.
And there's better feeding here. But the Red Wings, they're quite distinctive, actually, because maybe at a glance you might think robin-ish looking, but the red is on the side of their wing, the side of their body, not on their breast. And it's probably not as bright a red, but when you see them in a group and stuff, it's very distinctive. And they'll both feed on insects, worms, slugs and berries, but sometimes you might see the red wing feeding on berries in a garden. Their field fare tend to stay in fields, but you might see them coming into a garden and stuff, even in a town garden, to feed on berries. And that's a nice picture because the little red on them and then red berries if they're feeding on them is quite nice.
I must look out for them. Have you seen them in Kilkenny?
There are in Kilkenny and stuff.
Okay.
I haven't noticed them this year, but I know I passed a field, kind of a stubbly field, and there was a flock of something, but it wasn't sure if it was, it might have been field fare. Chances are it was actually, but
okay.
It wasn't 100% sure. But so if you keep an eye out for kind of the red on the side of the Red Wing, and then the field fare, kind of like a greyish looking thrush, maybe.
Okay.
A bit smaller.
with that kind of speckled breast.
Kind of speckled, yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Kind of brown and speckledy.
You mentioned them maybe coming into the garden to feed off berries. This time of the year, we have lots of visitors to the garden looking for food. And I've noticed on the feeders in my garden, the last couple of weeks, they're lasting, like a full feeder is now lasting less than a day. Whereas I was filling the feeder just a couple of weeks ago and they were lasting 3, 4, 5 days because the sparrows and so on were finding food elsewhere. But now it's less than a day.
But there's still a lot of food in the hedges. There's a lot of berries in that. So I think feeders are easy for birds.
Right.
They know exactly where they are. They just stand there and feed. You know, they don't have to work too hard.
So it's not that they need them.
Stuff.
It's just the news has got out.
I wonder about now. Okay. I think they've just, it's habit and convenience. Mm. We were talking about convenience food earlier, so I think it is actually.
Oh my God, am I making the garden birds fat?
It's hard to make them fat at the same time.
Well, it is important, I think, at this time of the year, if you like having birds around the garden, to kind of give them some food out there. And there's lots of proprietary mixes now in every hardware shop and garden centre.
Loads of different types of feeders if you want.
Not like that expensive
gold
either.
Finches, there's a, you know, the. But also if you have any pumpkins left, you can kind of hang your, so maybe take the top off it if you've done this and then tie it up and hang it in a tree and the birds will just feed away in it, or you can put some feed into it and they'll feed away on it.
Or you can throw it into my field full of turkeys and they'll help themselves to it.
Well, yes.
They love it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I gave mine to the pigs. They, their last meals
oh,
and stuff.
Oh, now
they
pigs love the pumpkins.
Oh, they nearly stick their heads into it.
Oh, they fire it around the place. It's
grunting,
like a toy for them as well as everything else, yeah.
So there's no need to ever put a pumpkin in the bin because wildlife will take it. If you shove it to the hedge at the bottom of your garden and stuff, something will nibble away and eat that.
That's true, actually.
Yeah, you don't need, like, it really shouldn't go in, you know, if you're not going to use it and stuff, it shouldn't go in the bin. It's an awful waste.
The chickens were actually picking at some of the seeds. I have to admit, I didn't wash and dry and roast any of the pumpkin seeds this year. I just didn't bother. And they went, while I was doing them with the kids out in the garden, the chickens were picking at some of the seeds, so I fired out all the seeds to the chickens. Now, it took them a long time to get through them, but they did eventually. They all vanished eventually.
Yeah.
Because they are, they're big,
they
like
are
for
big.
A little chicken, you know. But anyway, they all vanished. Something ate them. They weren't lying around the garden. And speaking of garden, there's some jobs to be doing at this time of the year. It's very, very wet now, but there won't be much grass cutting going on. But if you are about to do the last cut, remember to raise the height of the blades. And I'm basically using the mower now just to collect leaves. So I cut the last of the grass a little while ago. And now I'm, with the blades on the highest setting, I'm flying around just gathering up the leaves and they're going into the leaf mould bin.
It's like a Hoover.
It is. It's like a Hoover. It makes it a bit easier. It's a bit easier than raking. And the leaf mould bin, I suppose it's 4 feet high because it's a sheet of 8x4 that I made it from, of galvanised mesh. And I fill it to overflowing. And then you come back 2 or 3 days later and it's half full. So the leaves have just compressed down, all of the air has gotten squished out. So I've filled that now 5 times it's still kind of squashing itself down. Now, I don't turn it or do too much with it, so it'll probably be 2 years before those leaves turn into beautiful little leaf mould that I can use for seedlings and so on. But it's a fantastic way of producing free compost for yourself, is gathering up the leaves and try and keep the grass out from it. Otherwise, it turns into a nitrogen-rich fertilizer or compost, which isn't really suitable for seedlings. Because
so you just want leaves.
You just want leaves.
Just gonna
when you're getting the seedlings started in spring, you want them to put down lots and lots of roots rather than lots and lots of green. So you want a healthy plant from the bottom. And once it has a nice, healthy root system, then it will develop, you know, kind of in a better way. Whereas if you use a lot of nitrogen in your seed mix, that encourages the production of green growth, and then you don't have the root system to sustain that. And the first time it gets dry, because remember the leaves lose moisture, first time it gets dry, it suffers a setback, or it may even die.
Okay.
So you want more roots than green growth in your seedlings. So your seed compost should have very little nutrition in there at all. And leaves have very little in them. So it's basically just a substrate for the seed, for the roots to get established in. And leaf mould is the best job for that. It's also a good time to take some hardwood cuttings. So if you have any fuchsia that you want to take any cuttings from, or if you want to take cuttings from lavenders or rosemaries and so on, now's the time that you can do all of that. And it's a good time to move any of the herbaceous plants in the gardens, like hostas, that you want to kind of move or split or propagate in that kind of way. They're not growing at the moment. So it's an ideal time of the year to be moving them. And if, like me, you find some bulbs sitting in the potting shed or in the garage or whatever, get them into the ground. I found a bag of bulbs I'd forgotten I even bought. And when I got them, they were kind of a bit past their best before, so they were on special offer. But of the 100, only one of them was gone dodgy, gone soft. So 99 bulbs went down in the garden there the other day. It only took me 20 minutes.
What sort of?
Mostly they were crocuses. They were already starting to sprout. So they went down into the woodland garden. And I'm hoping they'll provide a splash of colour now in the spring. Because they've gone in late, I wouldn't be surprised if half of them at least didn't produce a flower next year. Yeah. But if they were able to survive over this winter and next year, there will be flowers there the year after.
Yeah,
and
very good.
Every year I plant some more bulbs about the place, particularly in the woodland garden, the small little anemones and crocuses and so on, because it's very expensive to do a massive display in one go. But if every year you spend a tenner on bulbs, after 5 or 10 or whatever number of years, that's an awful lot of bulbs.
Yeah, well, I put down 120 tulips,
but I've
actually stopped putting down anything that's not fenced in the veg garden now because of geese and hens. They just will destroy everything and a puppy, in fairness. Mm. So I have beds of tulips.
Well, it's a great time to be planting your tulips now because there is a disease, a nasty disease called the tulip fire infection. I don't know whether you've ever heard of that. But if you get them in now, it doesn't affect them because of the cold weather. So, well done, that was perfect. Now, we're not going to hear the whole of this song, but given the absolutely miserable weather that's out there, I did think it appropriate to finish up with a version of November Rain, because it is very, very rainy and it is November. This isn't by Guns N' Roses, it's by a kind of hillbilly band from the US called Steven Seagulls, and it was out in 2016. I really, really like it, and I hope you enjoy it too, and I hope you enjoyed the show today. And remember, we're back live next Friday from 4 to 5, and this show is repeated on Monday 4 to 5. You can stay in touch with us during the week on Twitter. I'm at NesbitF and Mags is at Mags Morrissey, or you can email kitchengarden@crkc.ie. Stay tuned for Morris on Community Radio Kilkenny City. He's up next, and we'll speak to you again next week.
When I look into your eyes, I can see a love restrained. But darling, when I hold you, don't you know I feel the same? There's nothing lasts forever, and we both know hearts can change. And it's hard to hold a candle in the cold November rain. We've been through this such a long, long time, just trying to kill the pain. Love has always come and love has always gone, and no one's really sure who's letting go today. Walking away. We could take the time to lay on the line. I could rest my head just knowing that you were mine. Oh, mine. So if you wanna love me, then darling, don't refrain. Or I'll just end up walking in the cold November rain. Some time on your own. Do you need some time all alone? No, everybody needs some time on their own. Don't you know you need some time all alone? I know it's hard to keep an open heart. And even friends seem out to harm you. But if you could heal a broken heart, wouldn't time be out to charm you?
Sometimes I need some time on my own. Sometimes I need some time all alone. Ooh, everybody needs some time on their own. Don't you know you need some time all alone? And shadows still remain.